This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Zvi Fat Chicks. And this week's episode is about the omnivore's dilemma. And this is a re-record because the other record just didn't turn out because somebody came in and started acting a fool.
Yes. We went to some place for coffee, and the patrons were very young and very loud after we had started recording.
But it was halfway through, so...
Yeah.
That was the crummy part. But we did see Terry. That was pretty awesome.
Yes, it was. So the omnivore's dilemma, where do you want to start with this one?
I guess we should actually define it.
Yes.
Because you actually read the entire book and then still wasn't sure what the omnivore's dilemma was.
I had no idea what the omnivore's dilemma was. Yeah.
The omnivore's dilemma is that because we have access to so many things to eat, who knows what to eat is basically trial and error. A cow does not have any dilemma because it knows it's going to eat grass. A panda doesn't have any dilemma. It knows it's eating bamboo shoots. There's no room for speculation of where that next meal is going to come from. The advantage being, if there's no grass, if there's no bamboo, cows, pandas, they're gone. Us, we will survive. Us, the boars, the raccoons, and the pigs, and all the other omnivores on this planet.
The rats.
Yes.
The cockroaches.
So.
So that was the omnivore's dilemma, which I did not actually get from the whole book. The reason we read it is because it's not the root of a lot of the other literature that we've already talked about in terms of food culture, but it's pretty important. And when you look at the organic movements, you look at the sustainable agriculture movements.
Yeah, the local for the local eating,
mm-hmm.
That whole movement.
They all reference this book. So it's pretty influential, and now that we've read all of these other things, we thought we'd go back and read something that influenced all of these other books we had read. Just like how we did it backwards, where we read all of these books about restaurant culture, and then went Kitchen Confidential. Same thing. So I found it, just as an overall review, I found it very hard to read.
You can tell that this was maybe one of his first projects as a book.
Yeah.
And I've heard he's written later books, and that you can tell that he's grown as an author when you read them. It was rather dry and technical.
He had sections that were fabulously written, easy mm-hmm. to read. They flowed. They had really good, what's the word I'm looking for? Pacing. There's something else to it, but it's like the word pacing. I'm having a stupid day. It's my day off, excuse me. And there were parts where he just slogged through it. He went through the one section where he went into the history of corn.
Right. And the funny thing is that we watched the Good Eats episode with the nutritional anthropologist Deb Duchon, and she basically summarized the history of corn in like 30 seconds. He took like 60 pages. Yeah. It was like, it was long.
It might not have been 60, but it felt like 60 pages. So yeah. There were some sections where
it was
really
something that
too much.
Could have probably been done in like maybe 2 pages. But
also in defense of what he did, that may have been the first time that people saw the full impact and why he had to explain it all. Just like when he talked about fertilizer, most people mm-hmm. wouldn't have known that because he wrote not the original expose, but
yeah.
One of the original modern books that really opens our eyes to a lot of that. So I get why he did what he did, but
mm-hmm.
I did not find it an easy read. And I'm the kind of person who sits down and reads some pretty difficult stuff, and I usually plow right through. And yeah. This one took forever.
It's an important book to read. It is definitely worthwhile to read, but prepare yourself that there are some very technical chapters.
Yes. But you're going to hit a middle section, and you're just going to fly right through
oh, yeah.
it because it's so awesome. So let's just start talking about the actual contents. He breaks it down into 4 areas, really.
Yeah.
So he talks about corn, beef, chickens... And then he does this, like, hunter-gatherer thing.
Yeah, like, he didn't mention this until almost 3/4 of the way through the book, but he wanted to put together a meal that he had completely gotten himself.
Mm-hmm.
He could get help, but he wanted to gather, kill, or, you know, grow
yeah.
everything in this meal that he was going to prepare for his friends.
So for the corn, he picks corn because it's in everything we eat. In the beginning of the book, he takes his family out to McDonald's to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And then he breaks down how much of the meal was either derived from corn or ate corn before they ate it.
Right.
And that's kind of his springboard into the rest of it. And corn really, if you've seen Food Incorporated, it's no surprise to you. This book really is the precursor to Food Incorporated. He was
yeah.
involved in Food Incorporated, just like Eric Schlosser was involved in it.
Just like Crazy Farmer Guy is involved in it.
Yes.
And he goes to Crazy Farmer Guy's farm.
In fact,
Joel Salatin.
We had an electronic copy of this book, and we read it at the exact same time. So we kept comparing notes throughout the week or so we took to read it. And we kept saying, it's like the book version of Food Incorporated. Food
mm-hmm.
Incorporated is the movie version of this book.
Yeah, so if you're one of the slackers that can't stand to read the book, and you need to just watch the movie, watch Food Incorporated, and you'll pretty much get everything. as long as you listen to this podcast as well.
Yes. And make sure your friends listen to it too. So, but it's no surprise. Corn is in everything. We derive so many chemicals that we turn around and put right back into the food from corn that it's fed to the beef, it's fed to the chicken, it's fed to everything. Mm. Farmers don't really grow crops anymore. They just grow corn because they get paid better for it. There's not as much market to grow everything else.
But then there's this weird kind of... They have to grow so much corn in order to make money, but because they're growing more corn, it's depreciating the amount that they get for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's this crazy, vicious cycle.
It has to do with how the agricultural, I want to say food bank, but that's not really what it is set up, and how the government subsidizes it. And it went through a shift around the 60s. And I will give Michael Pollan full kudos here. He explains how government subsidies for farmers work better than anybody I've ever read.
Yeah.
And it actually...
Because I really had no idea, to be honest.
It makes a lot of sense. I don't have it right here in front of me to really go through it, but if you've ever been curious, reading the book is almost worth it just for that, because it's very plain and put right out front. This mm-hmm. is what it used to be like. This is how it is now. And because of the way it was changed and reset up in the 60s now, if they have to produce more to keep up, but as they produce more, like you said... It devalues the price of it instead of it just going into this, like, massive national grain silo, which isn't really what it was, but that's what it was, against right. future losses, which is what the system used to be like before.
To protect against. So you don't have things like the Great Depression totally coming and wiping everything out.
And then there's, if you're not growing corn, you're growing soy. If you're not growing soy, you're growing corn. It goes back and forth between the two of them. I also liked how he explained about why we're so much more productive as farmers when it comes to growing corn now.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I thought we just had these super stocks that produced, like, extra grains
like
of corn or
20
kernels.
20 ears of corn on it or whatever, or these monstrous forearm-sized ears of corn or something. It has to do with you actually are able to plant the corn closer together. So it's pretty much stacked right on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. It's tenement housing for corn.
Yeah.
They're now corn slums.
Which is totally different than how the Native Americans used to grow it, where they had the three sisters. And you can actually do this in your home farm. You plant the corn, and then you plant the beans around it so that the beans have something to climb on. And then you plant the squashes, or pumpkins, which are squash, around that. And they choke off all the weeds so you don't have to weed. I mean, this is farming with the least amount of effort because calories count mm-hmm. if you're an indigenous people. And there's no grocery store for you to just go on down to and get some pot pies.
And that's something I had no idea about until Sheila kind of clued me in on it too when we read the book. So he goes from the corn thing and he just segues right into cattle. Because our beef in the United States are mostly... grain fed once they get off the off the farm.
Yeah.
Cattle are still raised for about their first year off at a farm. They aren't locked in little stalls like we think. They're fairly
No. Their first year is actually pretty decent. It's still pretty traditional as to what you would think of when you think of a calf being born and being raised. It's only after that, when they're being sent to the feedlot to fatten up, that you hear the horror stories of them standing in their own crap and
mm-hmm.
it being not so nice.
Oh, and if you hear some funny background noise right now, we're in the car recording because the Starbucks was way too angry to record in there today.
Yeah.
So, you may hear the rain on the windshield. But yeah, it's what you think of when you think of a farm. It's the picture of the rancher on the horse, herding the cattle, that sort of thing. What was that documentary we watched on Netflix about the wolves and the cattle ranchers out west?
Oh, I can't remember what the name of it was, but it was talking about how they wanted to get rid of the wolves because the wolves were incurring losses because they couldn't just let the cows walk around unattended. And my main argument was, you're a rancher. Go ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Be with the cows. Sorry you can't just turn them loose like, I don't even know, I don't even have an allegory for that, but sorry you can't just...
Turn them loose like street urchins.
Yeah.
I mean... That was their problem, which I get. You don't want to lose too many cattle to the wolves and that sort of thing, but you have to keep an eye on them once in a while. You can't turn them loose for, like, weeks on end.
And that's what they were doing.
And the people who would actually go out and patrol them, and they were doing it on ATVs. It wasn't even like they had to go live off of a horse, out of the back of a horse.
It's not like Brokeback Mountain where you had to have a couple of homosexual ranch hands camping up there looking after your sheep or whatever. Just go out on the ATV once in a while and check on them, make sure they're okay.
They just went out a couple times a week to check on the cattle, and they were fine. Mm-hmm. Kept the wolves away.
You need the wolves in that kind of ecosystem, because if you don't, you'll have an overpopulation of deer. And the deer will compete with the cows.
Anyways, beside the point. But that kind of environment, that's what cows are still raised in until they go to the feedlot. At which point, we pump them full of grain because they will gain weight faster.
Yeah.
Paulin ended up buying a cow and taking it all the way through. He wanted to take it through the whole process. They wouldn't let him into the slaughterhouse to see it slaughtered, though.
Yeah.
But he got to see it kind of go down the ramp and everything into it.
Say goodbye.
Yeah, say goodbye to Lumpy.
It didn't have a name, it just had a...
No, he didn't name it.
He just had a number.
I called it Lumpy when I was reading it, though.
Yeah.
So, he went through that whole process, and the cow is treated with a lot of drugs, a lot of antibiotics, which, on one hand, it's good because then you don't lose as much in terms of head count for your steer. But on the other hand, there's still some questions as to how good or bad some of these antibiotics and hormones are for us.
Because once it goes into the meat, it's not like it doesn't go into us when we eat it.
Yeah. There's still a lot of question as to how safe this practice is. Go read and make your own judgments on it. He presents it in a fairly unbiased light, I thought. I was rather impressed with him being a real journalist and not trying to completely change your mind on that one. So he decides to juxtaposition how that process is with the grain-fed cattle being fattened up and drugged and everything to what it would be like if it wasn't necessarily organic but raised in a more sustainable way. And that's where we get back to Crazy Farmer Guy from Food Incorporated.
Joel Salatin.
We love him.
He is so cool. So if somebody actually put a gun to my head and said, Sheila, you have to have a hobby farm. This is the way it's going to be and you're going to have to do it for one year or I'm going to come and shoot you in the head. This is how I'd do it. Because everything fits together perfectly, which helps everything grow, and also it makes it easy. Why do things the inefficient way when you can do things the easy way?
I love this guy's system.
Okay, so let me think here. It starts off with the cows. Now, he rotates the cows from different pastures because you can't have them just sit on one pasture because they will eat everything. A lot of ranchers are like, trying to move the cows is like, I don't know.
Herding cats.
Trying to bowl with babies or something.
And they also can't stand the thing because they'll just poop it to death too.
Yeah, their crap will eventually kill all the grass.
Yeah.
And they'll end up eating their own crap and it'll be bad. So he's got his pasture set up into quarters. And he lets the cows stay on that quarter for a couple of days. And then he moves them to the next one. But the way he moves them, the cows totally cooperate. He plays to their inborn instincts, because even though we've domesticated them, and even though they're not very smart, and they probably need us to survive, they still do have instincts. He moves them at night, and the cows know, after they've done this once or twice, they realize, and they totally cooperate, that if they go to the next pasture, there will be clover there. And clover is like the best vanilla ice cream you've ever had to a cow.
And because it's at sunset, it's when the sugar in the clover is at its highest content.
Yeah.
So the cattle aren't just getting ice cream, like vanilla ice cream. They're getting Ben and Jerry's amazing vanilla ice cream.
Exactly.
So.
It's like trying to move kindergartners. If you just say, we need you all to get up and move in this other room and not dilly-dally, they're going to be forever. But if you're like, hey kids, we got ice cream in this room, they're like, woo!
And they're all just like mob their way to it.
Exactly.
Same thing with the cows.
That's pretty much what the cows do.
He just opens up the fence, takes down the electric part, and the cows just kind of say, hey, it's open, let's go, kids.
Yeah.
So then, 2 days later, he brings in the cleanup crew for the previous pasture, because you can't let all the cow crap sit there and spawn badness.
Exactly. Because the cow crap it attracts flies, and if they do have some sort of diseases or parasites, you don't want them to go back and eat it and propagate the parasites within them. So he brings in these mobile chicken coops, because chickens love grubs. And you can't have to make sure that it's no longer than...
He said 2 days,
2 days, because otherwise the maggots will get little wings and fly away.
Mm-hmm.
So you bring in the chickens eat the maggots from the poop, and they eat any sort of lice or anything like that. They totally decontaminate that entire section of pasture. And the chickens love it. Again, it's not hard to move the chickens because they're excited about getting some fresh grub action.
Well, they're in their mobile chicken coop. He's designed these, like, crazy... It's a chicken coop on wheels. It's almost like a giant truck. And they just drive it from pasture to pasture, and then they put the chicken back in it when they're done.
Mm-hmm.
But then, because it's such a high-protein diet, the chicken's eggs are supposed to be just out of this world.
Yeah.
Someday, when we're back in that area, because Polyface Farms isn't far from the D.C. area, we are going to go get a dozen eggs from there. Come heck or high water, I have to try these
eggs.
I
would also love to get one of their chickens, too.
Yes. So, he has the whole little rotation thing going with the chickens and the cattle. But it doesn't stop there, because he's in Virginia, they still get winter, kind of. So he has to put the cattle in a barn in the winter. And the worst part about putting your cattle in a barn in winter is that you have to clean the barn.
Because they're in there eating and crapping pretty much all winter long.
And he has another cleanup crew to do that.
So what he does is every day he goes in there and he has this mixture of wood chips and corn. And he throws that down on the cow crap that has accumulated. And the cows stamp that down. And they crap some more. Then he goes in the next day and he throws some more wood chips and corn on it. Till eventually, by the end of winter, when spring comes, there's probably about 2 or 3 feet of compacted cow crap
and corn.
Corn.
Fermenting
and wood chips.
Corn.
And it's already becoming its own, what's that stuff?
Compost?
Yeah, it's already becoming compost.
Its own fertilizer.
So he takes the cows out, sends the pigs in, because pigs love fermented corn. Who doesn't? It's like whiskey bot drops, you know?
Yeah.
So the pigs go in there and they use their little snouts and they
root
around.
Pigs do best.
They turn that compost like it's never been turned before.
And they dig out all the corn and eat it. And incidentally, it loosens all the compost. So then
so
he just has to go
back
in and
the
shovel
truck
it up.
And shovel it up. And
yeah.
You've got ready-made compost that you can put on your field. You don't have to do anything to it.
And instead of having to clean the barn out every winter and making a whole lot of work for themselves, it's not nearly as bad.
At least you're getting something out of it.
Yeah.
It makes it productive.
Exactly. Then there's the turkeys, too.
Yes. Well, turkeys, they like to eat grass, and they like to eat grubs. So what he does is he keeps his turkeys in the orchards and the vineyards, where grubs might be attacking the fruit, and he lets the turkeys live in there. So not only do they eat the grass around the grapevines to make it easier for the grapevines to grow, they don't have any competition, eating the grubs off of the fruit, whether it be the apples or the grapes. He also has their water pens. Birds are notoriously pretty dirty when it comes to their own water. They stand on it and crap in it, and it's pretty bad. And you have to change it every day. So he has the bins for water, or the troughs for water there. They drink it, they crap in it. He comes by every day, kicks it over onto the roots of the vineyard or the orchard, and refills it. So it's already getting this liquefied bird crap fertilizer that's totally natural, and they're getting rid of all the pests.
So with all of this awesome, natural, amazing rotational farming that he does, he is not certified organic.
Can you imagine?
Because it's too much paperwork.
Yep. I don't even think he's even using any unnatural fertilizers besides compost and animal crap.
He's about as organic and natural as you can get, and he's not actually certified organic. Whereas, now his chickens, they slaughter them outside. His chickens have been tested, and they come out, I can't even tell you how many times cleaner with a lower bacteria count than, like, chickens processed in a plant.
Yeah,
the FDA came in and had like a hissy fit.
Yeah, but they have like pretty much almost no salmonella.
Yeah.
Because they're clean birds.
They're clean birds because they're not living in their own crap. They're not living and cooped up in the chicken lodges. I don't know what else to call them. They're pretty horrifying.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's the thing is like if it's free range in Omnivorous Dilemma, a lot of times it says like they have access to an open yard. But all that means is when they're a chick, they'll grow until they're, like, what, a couple months old?
It's like 6 weeks, I think.
They keep them inside because they don't have an immune system yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then they open the door. Well, by then they've gotten so used to being inside, they don't want to go outside. So that door stays open. That farmyard stays clear of chickens. None of them go out. It's totally pointless.
Yeah, Michael Pollan went out to a chicken farm that was supposed to be organic. And there's just all these coops with one little tiny door open and no chickens in the yard whatsoever.
Yep.
It was one of the same places that supply the chickens to
Whole Foods?
Whole Foods. Because he bought the Whole Foods chicken and it's a cute little thing because it's packaged up and it has a name of the chicken on the front. And
right.
You buy it and you feel good about yourself and you picture these birds roaming around pastures picking the grubs out of cow poop.
Yep.
No. Not at all the same thing. So if you're interested in getting things from Polyface Farms, you kind of have to go to that area. They don't ship, which is good because he's trying to be responsible and everything.
Right.
But I guess when he started up, he tried to sell, when he was trying to sell his eggs to the local chefs, he would actually crack an egg open and separate the yolk out in his hand to show them how stable and awesome the eggs were. So
yeah.
They could see the yolk, which is hard to do with an egg that isn't good.
Yeah. If it's the least bit stale, if it's an inferior egg.
Yeah.
And it's not going to have that bright mustard, like dark gold color for the yolk. You can only get that from a high protein diet from grubs.
Now that does mean the eggs are a little bit different in the winter though. And the chefs in the area actually talked to the author about it and they said, well, first there was some concern from the farm because the eggs have a different makeup because they're not getting the same high protein diet in the summer in the winter as they are the summer. But all the chefs did is break out their old recipes because way back in the day, cooks used to notate recipes for the different seasons because they knew some of the times their ingredients would react differently. They'd have a lower protein content or a higher sugar content or something like that for the different things. So they just said, okay, this is what we do when we have winter eggs.
Yep.
And they're still using the same awesome eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of the book, the book's worth reading just for the section on polyphase farms.
Yeah, even if you just read that, that's totally awesome.
Yeah. Then at the end, he goes back to the West Coast and he does some hunting and some gathering, which was really cool, actually, too.
This is also an amazing part of the book, too. Just skip the corn chapter altogether as far as like that goes. Just watch Food Incorporated. But this part is pretty decent because he ends up going mushroom hunting. And there are different mushroom hunters. The one guy he finds is actually a professional one who just like lives out of his van and just drives from area to area, hunting ground to hunting ground, and sells all of his mushrooms to high-grade restaurants. And then there's, of course, enthusiasts, too. And myconologists that he was going out with. And there was these two Italian guys that were with him at the hunting trip and also with him when he was hunting for mushrooms.
And the mushroom hunting, it's funny. A lot of good anecdotes. It's interesting to read. If you have any interest in mushrooms at all, you'll probably really enjoy it. I think Sheila did everything but throw her e-reader down and roll around on the book. She was so happy for that section. She's got a thing for mushrooms. It's hilarious.
It's just a residual thing left over my DNA from my hobbity origins.
Apparently. Someday we're going to go on a mushroom walk. We just have to get in contact with the groups in the area and find an event that coincides with our schedules.
There's a Toronto Myconologist Club that I'm going to contact.
We will tell all of you about it someday. And then the hunting, he goes boar hunting. Because the Italian fellows that he knows, the one guy, his friend has a farm where it's more like property where there happen to be wild boar. I guess they don't have a problem with it in California, but they do have wild
boar.
They
do exist, yeah.
Which isn't as odd as it sounds, because you take a pig, you turn it loose in the woods for a couple of weeks, and it starts to go feral already. After a couple months, they look like wild pigs.
Yeah, they get their tusks start growing, they get this stubbly, scratchy fur. And
Exactly. So his first time out, he had all of these dilemmas about shooting an animal and kind of wussed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second time he went, he actually was able to kill one, and he went through all this kind of, well, I'm sorry, I have to say it, dirty hippie, wussy kind of thing, which that, to me, is part of the omnivore's dilemma for modern people. It's, I can't kill an animal, but if you're hungry and that's the only thing you have to eat, you're not going to have any problem saying, sorry, Bambi, you got to die.
Well, especially if it's a boar. Here we go. If you really want to compare apples to apples here, if you were out in the woods with your loincloth and pointy spear, that boar would have no problem at all goring the crap out of you and eating you.
Yeah.
If it's a case of eat or be eaten, you shouldn't feel bad about killing an animal, especially if you're going to eat it.
Yeah.
And with these Italian guys, they knew every cut on that pig.
Mm-hmm.
They stripped that thing pretty much clean. Because they had cuts for capicola, they used the intestines to make sausage. They took everything off that animal.
They had everything but the oink.
Yep.
I mean, I think they even were going to pickle the feet or something.
Yeah.
I mean, they were using the whole pig. So I wouldn't have had any twinges about that at all.
If you can kill mice because they're in your house eating your cereal, if you can stomp on spiders just because they're in your way, you shouldn't have any problem killing an animal if you're going to eat it.
Yeah.
As long as you do it quickly and humanely.
So, at the end of the whole thing, he finally puts together his meal where he had beans that he grew. It was part of the pig that he had killed.
Mm-hmm. It was a roast pork, wasn't it?
It was a roast. It was a pork. I don't know if it was the tenderloin or not, but he did a pork roast. He had the mushrooms that he had gathered and dried and some other things in the meal that he had gotten as well. He had involved himself in the process somehow. They didn't really write about it. So, overall, it was an interesting read. Now, we may have been a little prejudiced, too, because we felt like it took forever, because we did get an electronic copy of it. And some electronic copies, some ebooks, don't always tell you the total page count. They just give you the count for the chapter. This was one of them.
Yeah.
And it just felt like it was going on forever, because we couldn't easily see how far we were through the book.
Right.
So that may have been part of the problem, too. We felt like, we're most of the way through, and then we looked and we still had 25 chapters to go or something. So
it was just a matter of how the book was divided up.
Yeah. I mean, we love using an e-reader, but that is one of the hazards some of the time when you get them. Anything else you want to add on it?
I don't think so. I think that's pretty much it.
I feel like I'm a better food person for having read it.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like taking your medicine in a way.
In some parts, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to be going on vacation soon. This is still an irregular podcast, but hopefully we've got a really cool ZFC from the road.
Yes.
Show coming up for you guys.
We will definitely be eating our way through the East Coast down to Florida. So we'll hopefully have a few cool places to talk about. I also want to do a quick product review, because we did it the last time we tried to record this.
Oh, yeah.
We bought a ceramic knife.
Oh, my God!
We actually got a ceramic knife and a ceramic vegetable peeler. It was in a set. The ceramic vegetable peeler is mostly useless. I'm not impressed with it at all.
It has to, well, it doesn't have to do with the blade. It has to do with the angle that the head's set at.
Yeah.
However, it does make it pretty trying to use.
The ceramic knife is so awesome.
It's so sharp and scary.
It is. It goes through everything like butter. Just
I stabbed myself when through. I was using it.
I've dropped it a couple times, and it hasn't shattered yet. It's made out of a stronger polymer now than they used to be, I think, 10 or 20 years ago.
Ceramic knives used to have a reputation for being really sharp. You don't ever have to sharpen them, but very brittle. And now they're considerably less brittle than they used to be.
And much cheaper. We were able to get this as a double pack. It was only like $10. It was on sale, but still it was a good price. Regularly, it's about $20. But that means you can pick up a decent ceramic knife for under $20 now if you're willing to sharpen it a little bit. Yes. Respect it like a chainsaw. Because neither one of us did the first time, and we both cut ourselves.
Yeah, I was using it to get rid of some of the silver skin on a pork loin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting it to go through the silver skin that fast, because we have pretty dull knives right now. I need to go get a new edge put on my chef's knife. And it just slid right through it and stabbed me right in the hand, right in the webby part. It bled everywhere.
I walk around the corner, and she's cutting the tenderloin on the cutting board, and I kind of look at her and say, is the tenderloin bleeding that much, or is that you? She's like, no, that's my blood, but I'm almost done, so I'm not stopping. You can rinse it off. Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to cook it anyway.
I don't have
sure.
anything communicable.
Nobody else is eating it but us, but that, wow, be careful.
Yeah.
So, definitely recommend it if you like to cook, if you are frustrated with your knives, but put it in a separate part of the drawer so you don't have to worry about it getting dinged up.
Yeah.
We took one of our little, spots in the drawer that we didn't have a lot of stuff in, you know, where
like
we had little dividers.
Like utensil. Yeah. Containers.
And laid a couple paper towels in there, and we keep them in there so they won't ding up against the rest of the knives, or worse yet, we stick our hands in looking for something and cut ourselves.
Exactly. That's what I was most scared of.
I wish it had a knife sheath on it, and I need to swing by a kitchen store and get some kind of plastic knife sheath for it, because I'd feel a lot better.
Yeah.
So that's about all I had to add. So this is Tracy.
Oh, this is Sheila, and we are Zwei Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed the Zwei Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on Facebook and or follow us on Twitter. You can email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends. Please make sure that credit is given. Thanks for listening and have a great day.